you so much.
Please. I'll say that. She's gonna look.
Oye, oye, oye. The Honorable Supreme Court of the United States is now in session. The Honorable Justices O'Scanlan, Hartz, and Elrod serving. All parties having business before this court, come now and be heard. God save this honorable court.
Please be seated. We will now hear oral argument in the case of Harris versus Ector County Office of the District Attorney. Counsel for the appellant.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. First, may I reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal?
Certainly may, counsel. Well,
thank you. Good evening, Your Honors. My name is Aaron Chastain. Along with my co-counsel, David Dunn, I represent the petitioner in this case, Thomas Harris. We hope to show tonight why Mr. Harris's speech is protected by the First Amendment under Connick, under Garcetti, and under Pickering. I will be discussing the Garcetti analysis. Mr. Dunn will be discussing the Pickering and the Connick test. Would Your Honors like a brief review of the facts of the case?
I don't think it's necessary, counsel. I mean,
thank you, Your Honors. Absolutely.
The materials.
We'll move right into it then. Mr. Harris has a case for retaliation and violation of his First Amendment rights. To make a prima facie case, he has to meet three elements. First, his speech has to be protected by the First Amendment. Second, he has to show that he suffered an adverse employment action. And third, he has to show that the speech substantially contributed to that adverse employment action. In this case, the second two elements have been conceded. So the only question for the court tonight is whether the speech is protected by the First Amendment. And this is a question of law. And at this stage in the proceedings, all reasonable inferences must be granted to Mr. Harris because we're on appeal of summary judgment for the respondents.
Well, there were three different communications here, were there not?
Absolutely, Your
Honor. First to his superior, then to the Attorney General, and then to the blogger.
Yes, Your Honor. And
your position is that all three communications were protected?
Well, yes, Your Honor. We have colorable arguments why all three are protected by the First Amendment. But if a single instance of speech is protected in a retaliation claim, that creates a fact question of whether the protected speech is what led to his retaliatory transfer. And because that's a fact question, under the Mount Healthy test, that needs to go back down to the district court for more fact-finding or for a trial. And so our position is, if a single instance of his speech is protected by the First Amendment, then the lower court's judgment needs to be reversed. In order to evaluate whether the speech is protected, we apply this court's holdings in Pickering, in Connick, and Garcetti. Now, the Pickering test is the single test for speech. It says, we're going to balance the interests of the speaker, who's still a citizen but becomes a public employee, and balance those interests against the interests of his employer, the government.
You don't get to Pickering, do you, until you go through the Garcetti door? In other words, was this speech in the course of his duties, or was it speech of public concern?
Well, of course, Your Honor. What it is Pickering sets the foundation and sets the principle for the two future tests, the Garcetti test and the Connick test. Now, each the Garcetti and Connick is dispositive. It's a necessary element in order for speech to be protected. Under Garcetti,
how does speech to the superior, the supervisor, qualify as Garcetti speech?
Well, Your Honor, Garcetti tests whether speech is made pursuant to official duties. This court, however, has gauged a similar situation to Mr. Harris's speech to a supervisor before and has said that that kind of speech is not appropriate for review in a retaliation claim. In Rankin versus McPherson, this court heard a case where the plaintiff had said speech that was protected in its original context and then she was forced to repeat that speech to her supervisor in the office. And this court held that it was not going to consider the second instance of speech in the office to the supervisor because that would simply undermine the values that are being protected here. And our contention is, under the same reasoning, when Mr. Turner called Mr. Harris into his office, asked him what he said in a different context, in a context where it was protected, and forced him to repeat that speech, the court shouldn't consider that as a separate instance of speech in this case.
What about the statements to the blogger?
Yes, Your Honor. Going back to the Garcetti standard for this part, Garcetti falls obviously within the first part of the test, whether the speech is protected as a matter of law. This court has held that the burden for proving that in the other parts of the test fall on one part or the other. Under Connick, the burden is on the plaintiff. In Pickering, this court has held that burden falls on the defendant employer to justify the discharge. We're arguing tonight that this court should clarify that implying the Garcetti test in an instance such as the speech to the blogger, the burden should be on the employer. And
regardless of whose burden it is, how do you argue that that was not made as in the course of his employment?
Of course, Your Honor.
As a government employee, not as a private citizen.
Well, in Garcetti, this court held that when a job duty gave rise to the opportunity to speak, gave rise to the obligation to speak, by the word duty signified that that is public speech. It's not protected by the First Amendment. This is different. Mr. Harris went to the blogger. He went on his own time. Once again, there's no indication of how he came in contact with the blogger, but since all reasonable inferences must be given in his favor, she might have contacted several other people before she came to him. So he came in touch with this blogger on his own time, and he indicated that his personal thoughts about how the office was run.
The facts were that Harris granted an interview to the blogger.
Well, he did.
It sounds like the blogger initiated contact.
Well, yes, Your Honor. The facts do seem to indicate that the blogger initiated the contact, but
well, that... Doesn't that... Why would the blogger contact Harris if it weren't in Harris's capacity as a public servant, as an assistant DA?
Well, this court has...
Taking a poll of the public.
Absolutely, Your Honor. This court has drawn a distinction between having knowledge of public works and having a duty to speak about these public things. This court has constantly held that public officials have information that should be out into the community and should be protected when they convey that information. So in the sense that the blogger probably did seek out Harris rather than the other way around, that still is not dispositive of whether he had a job duty to go speak to the blogger. There's no indication in the record anywhere that he had ever done that before in any other capacity, that he constantly did so, that he had talked to the blogger before. And Honor,
the prosecutor is prosecuting the case and a reporter comes up during a break or calls afterwards and asks to talk about the case. That's part of your job duty, is how to deal with that inquiry, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, under the laws of Texas, Texas Code actually recognizes that when a prosecutor is representing the state in a case, he has some limited duty to speak to the public. But this is separate from that. This is a case that Mr. Harris was not representing the state. This is a case he had no control over, he had no interaction with. It's a case he only had knowledge about. And that distinction is a significant one. He was not acting in any kind of official capacity when he went and spoke to the blogger.
Why did the blogger have any interest in talking to Harris except that Harris was a prosecutor?
Well, Your Honor, it's the simple the fact he had the information. The blogger could have been equally interested in a secretary or someone else in the office that had access to the kind of information that Mr. Harris had, but that wouldn't make it a job duty for him to go and speak on that information.
Well, it would be a job duty to respond. The response may have been, I'm not supposed to talk about this. Talk to the district attorney, not me. Surely the public servant who's called in his or her capacity as a public servant has a responsibility. That's part of every public employee's job, is it not?
No, Your Honor, I would have to disagree that every public servant has a constitutional duty to respond, because that would effectively wipe out any First Amendment protections when someone outside initiates the contact with the public servant. And, Your Honor, we would argue that's not consistent with how this court has viewed First Amendment protections for employees in Keyesian when a university professor makes contact. When any time someone makes contact with the outside world, the distinction shouldn't be who initiated it. It can still be someone coming in and asking questions, knowing they might have answers, but outside of their official duties. We'll move to the
Counsel, what bothers me about your argument is that it seems to me you're trying to constitutionalize a disciplinary matter within an employer-employee relationship. The individual apparently felt that he had a better way to do this function than his superior thought, and except to the extent that there might have been some consideration about the favoritism toward a particular defendant. Most of this stuff had to do with a feeling that this person really deserved a promotion and didn't get it. Isn't that what this case is all about?
Well, Your Honor, first I'd like to return to the procedural posture. May I quickly answer your question?
I do so.
Oh, thank you. The procedural posture of the case is all reasonable inferences in Mr. Harris's favor. And we think that the reasonable inferences of the case would not support a position that he was doing this purely for his own personal gain or personal grievances. But furthermore, and maybe more importantly, this court has recognized in the past that this sort of speech is protected. It's not a constitutionalizing of every type of grievance. Garcetti was a very valid distinction. It says when you speak as a private employee, even if it's about something that happened in the office, if you're doing it outside of your job duties, that's valid, constitutionally protected speech. In this case, that's what it was. It was outside of his job duties and still merited First Amendment protection.
If it's a matter of public concern, I assume.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I'll turn the time over to my co-counsel to discuss that further. Thank you for your time.
Good evening, Your Honors. As Mr. Chastain said, my name is David Dunn, and I will primarily be discussing why Mr. Harris's speech was protected under Connick and Pickering. And I would like to begin, Chief Justice O'Scanlan, by addressing your question as to whether this is simply an attempt to constitutionalize an employee grievance. And we contend that it is not. I think the best way to see that is to contrast it to Connick, where in Connick, the employee, who is also an assistant district attorney, had been told she was being transferred to another division, had expressed her displeasure with that transfer. Her supervisor had told her that she was alone in her displeasure over the transfer policies, and she basically said, well, we'll see about that. Went home, wrote up a questionnaire with questions along the lines of, do you trust our supervisors? Do you have faith in our office transfer policy? And distributed that the next day at work. She was clearly just upset about being transferred. And when she was fired for what the district attorney in that case thought was a mini-insurrection, or described as a mini-insurrection, that was, she then filed her claim and essentially was trying to constitutionalize an employee grievance. In this case, it is true that Mr. Harris thought that he should receive more cases. He had been an assistant district attorney for over 4 years, had received uniformly positive job reviews, and he thought that, in light of that, he should receive better cases. However, he was currently up for promotion at the time these statements were made. There had been no adverse employment action taken against him prior to the statements. He was not trying to advance his career while he was up for promotion, going out and making public statements that he disagreed with the handling of one of the cases. That's simply not an intelligent move to make when one is trying to advance one's career. And he focused primarily on the most recent case, which was the lenient plea bargain that had been offered to this local political official, Bill Nelson, because the public had been outraged by this case. They had staged protests, they had written letters to the district attorney's office, and he agreed with the public that the plea bargain was unduly lenient in this case. In his letter to
did he say he agreed, or he didn't know if there were reasons? He didn't know whether spouse who had allegedly been abused had refused to testify or anything like that. Didn't he tell the blogger that he didn't know the facts, that some facts may justify this, but it looked bad?
He said that there are factors the public is not privy to see. He did not say specifically that he had not seen the facts, and he said that he understood the public outrage at this, that it at least gave the appearance of corruption and preferential treatment. But if you look to his letter to Attorney General Edwards, he included more information there. And he specifically said that in his over 4 years of experience prosecuting domestic violence cases as an assistant district attorney, he had never seen another case with the same amount of evidence against a defendant where the defendant had received such a lenient plea bargain. And he also identified what he believed to be a pattern of lack of uniformity in prosecution of domestic violence cases based solely or primarily on the defendant's status in society. And he identified this Nelson case as merely the most recent and glaring example of this.
Counsel, where do you think the Fifth Circuit went wrong here? I think that you think that their balancing was not how you would balance it, but that's not a that's just taking the facts and saying we balance these facts and come down. I don't know what's exactly cert-worthy of this case, because you agree with their Garcetti analysis, except you want to clarify something, but you don't really need to clarify to win this case, do you?
Not the Garcetti, no, but we do not entirely agree with their Garcetti analysis. We disagree with their holding on his speech to Mr. Turner. For the reasons
you don't need that, though, do you?
No. As Mr. Chastain said, we only need one instance of speech to be protected.
So what did the Fifth Circuit do as a matter of law wrong? What is legally wrong?
It was the Pickering balancing. Yes, Your Honor, you're correct.
But they applied the correct test. They just came out differently in the facts than you would have.
Yes, but because this is a question of law and that we are now on an appeal of summary judgment, this court must review de novo the facts in this case and draw its own conclusions.
Right. Explain to me how we have to find the facts differently on this issue of law.
Yes.
In order to get to your Pickering-Connick balancing.
Certainly, Your Honor. Well, as Mr. Chastain said, the burden is on the government under Pickering to show that its interests outweigh the interests of both the employee in speaking on a matter of public concern and also the interests of the public in receiving the well-informed views of government employees.
Insulting the district attorney, doesn't that weigh heavily in the side of the government here?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, what was
Didn't
that?
Didn't he insult the district attorney in his speech?
No, Your Honor. He did not name any specific individuals in either instance of his speech.
But what
he insulted the district attorney's office, didn't he?
No, he said that he understood the public reaction. He may have prosecuted the case differently.
Saying it was corrupt? Did he ever say it was corrupt?
He said it gave the appearance, at least, of corruption. Yes.
Isn't that a terrible insult to say that your office is corrupt?
I suppose so, but if it's true, then it's something that ought to be said. The whole purpose of First Amendment protection is to maintain our governmental accountability. And to go back to Justice Hart's question earlier about why the blogger approached Mr. Harris, one of the primary reasons that this court has acknowledged, beginning in Pickering and before and all the way through, for maintaining First Amendment protection for government employees is that they are often the members of the community who are most well-informed about the operations of their governmental employers, and that if the public were denied their well-informed opinions, that would seriously injure the ability of the public to know what is going on and to hold its government accountable.
The speech was disruptive, wasn't it?
No, Your Honor, we argue that it was not very disruptive. The only disruption that the respondents have alleged is this overtime authorization in order to respond to Attorney General.
Well, isn't that significant, forcing the government to spend more money than was necessary because of the conduct of this individual outside the office?
Several responses to that, Your Honor. First, the record is incomplete as to just how substantial this overtime was. All we know is that several employees had to put in overtime. We don't know how many. We don't know how much overtime. It could have been two or three employees who had to put in an extra hour. At the procedural posture where we are, where all reasonable inferences must be made in favor of Mr. Harris, the record is simply not sufficient here for a reasonable fact finder to not be able to conclude that that was not a substantial disruption. Also, that only relates to his speech, to his letter to the Attorney General. It does not relate to his interview with the blogger, and therefore they have not alleged any disruption resulting from that speech. And again, I would say that while yes, on one sense, it is disruptive to force the government to incur expenses to do overtime, but I would say that the actual cause of that was the corruption and the lack of uniformity in prosecutions that was occurring in the district attorney's office, and that if we are going to protect First Amendment speech, the purpose of which is to, as I said before, maintain accountability in the government, it really would not be fair, would not make sense to weigh disruption that is actually caused by that corruption against the employee exposing that corruption in the Pickering balancing.
Is he really informing the public that much just by saying, in my opinion, without giving any of the basis of that opinion, his evaluation of the evidence, it is ambiguous as to whether he is saying he knows facts that weren't made public. But that seems... That doesn't further the debate very much, does it?
Well, Your Honor, this court has never held that in order to merit First Amendment protection, speech must add to or further debate.
In balancing the interests, you have an assistant DA who's not going to be able to work with any of the other assistant DAs. He's going to work with someone who's going to publicly disagrees with you, he's going to say, gee, that smells of corruption. That should have been prosecuted more forcefully. I would think, to balance out that disruption to the office, he's got to make some contribution to the public debate, rather than just saying, gee, that looked corrupt. That smelled corrupt. I can see why the public is upset.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I would first note that it's possible that all of his other assistant district attorneys agree with him, and may I finish answering this question?
Okay, finish.
Thank you. Agree with him, and therefore, any disruption that exists would be the result of the potential corruption. But getting to the contributing to the public discourse, we agree that Mr. Harris tempered his remarks in his interview with the blogger. He saw that there was, as I said, there was public outrage over this. There have been protests. There have been letters sent. There was anger in the community over the handling of this case. And he wanted to acknowledge that anger. He wanted to let the public know that it was not misplaced. But he did not want to cause an undue amount of disruption by coming out and saying specifically, I think District Attorney Turner is corrupt and should be replaced. What he did is he then followed up that interview with his letter to the Attorney General, where he disclosed more facts, specifically that in his experience of over 4 years prosecuting domestic violence cases, he had never seen a similarly situated defendant receive such a lenient plea bargain.
Thank you, Counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hear from the other side.
May it please the court, my name is Stuart Burkhalter. My co-counsel is Ms. Gannett Berhana, and today we represent the Ector County Office of the District Attorney and District Attorney George Turner. We ask that you affirm the lower court's rulings and grant summary judgment in our favor. The pivotal and very practical...
Now, we can't grant summary judgment as a Supreme Court of the United States, can we?
Yes, right. Excuse me, I meant just affirm the lower court's grantings.
All right, grantings of you'll summary be happy judgment. With me. Straight
excuse
affirmance.
Okay. Yes. Of course. The pivotal and very practical question to ask under any Garcetti analysis is this. Did the speaker make their statements as a citizen who did not work for the government? If you look at all three of the instances of speech, all three of them were made as an employee and not as a citizen who did not work for the government. First, the statement to the blogger, Tracy Scott. In this statement, ADA Harris says, there are many factors in these cases that the public is not privy to see. He is explicitly stating that he is not a member of the general public. He is not a citizen who does not work for the government. He's an employee with special knowledge and experience in the DA's office in Ector County that puts him in a position of greater authority to speak than an average citizen would. Secondly, this is... The Garcetti test is essentially trying to figure out whether or not you're speaking as a citizen or as an employee.
You're saying that anytime someone speaks based on knowledge acquired as a public employee, and that person is speaking as a public employee as opposed to as a citizen?
Not any time they speak, but when they speak with specialized knowledge that they gain in the day-to-day operations of their office, they are speaking on behalf of the office as an employee.
What court has articulated that test?
This court has laid down in Garcetti that when a public employee speaks pursuant to employment responsibilities, there is no relevant analog to speech by citizens who are not government employees.
That's the duty that Judge Hartz is talking about. When did it say that if you speak based upon specialized knowledge, that alone is enough?
The Third and Fifth Circuits have address this idea of specialized knowledge and experience, putting you in a position of greater authority than the average citizen. Now, that alone is not enough. Those are just that's one of many factors that you have to consider when you're trying to determine whether or not the individual is speaking as an employee or as a citizen. This court in Garcetti said the test is a practical one, that they weren't going to lay down any sort of comprehensive framework. This court in Garcetti also said that if you're not speaking as a citizen, the First Amendment does not protect your communications from employer discipline. So we need to determine whether or not they were speaking as a citizen or as an employee.
But you might have a good argument under Garcetti so far as the complaint to his superior is concerned, and maybe even to the Attorney General, but aren't you on kind of shifty ground when we talk about the interview with the blogger?
Well, as was discussed earlier, this was not a situation of ADA Harris sending a letter in to a newspaper, or in this day and age, it's not even a situation where he was posting a comment to a blog message board. He was contacted for an interview. He granted an interview in his capacity as the ADA who worked in the Ector County DA's office. This court in Garcetti looked explicitly, the Tenth Circuit in Green mentioned that you have to ask the question, is this the type of communication that would be attributable to the government office? In this situation, any layperson reading this blog would see that, yes, absolutely. The blogger asks him a question about a case that was prosecuted in his office, and he answers and mentions that, you know, there are many factors that the public is not privy to see, that he has special knowledge and he's speaking on behalf of his office. This court in Garcetti also said that official communications have official consequences. Supervisors must ensure that employees' official communications are accurate and promote employers' discipline, or promote employers' mission, excuse me. Garcetti laid out very clearly that the state has a very strong interest in regulating the speech of its employees. This court in Garcetti said, when entering government service, a citizen must by necessity accept certain limitations on his or her freedom of speech.
Well, suppose we parse it a little bit and separate out his complaint about his maltreatment and not getting promoted and look at it from the standpoint of his discomfort as a citizen with the potential favoritism that his superior engaged in. Can't we perhaps agree with you on the first two, but you're still stuck with what about his bringing to the attention of the public through the blogger about potential misconduct by the attorney, by the district attorney?
Well, this court, again, in Garcetti, at least in terms of speaking about whistleblowing, noted that there are other legal mechanisms in place. For instance, state statutes for whistleblowing or labor codes, that it's not the job of the judiciary to step in and say that we're going to constitutionalize some sort of complaint on behalf of this particular employee. Garcetti set forth the threshold test, what the Tenth Circuit and Casey called a heavy barrier. This court thought that the state's interest in regulating its employees and running an efficient office was so important that it needed to establish a threshold test beyond just the Pickering balancing test. And so in some instances, and all three of these are instances that would apply, the state's interest trumps that of the citizens. If I could move on very quickly to the letter to the Attorney General.
You're saying that Garcetti is just a special case of conic balancing?
No, Garcetti... Yes, absolutely. Garcetti lays out the initial threshold test that any speech by an employee must pass before it can even get to the question of whether or not it was on a matter of public concern and whether or not it would pass a Pickering balancing test.
I take it your co-counsel will speak to the balancing side of this issue.
Yes, the matter of public concern and the Pickering balancing test.
I hear you on the letter to the Attorney General. That does not appear to have been in his chain of command.
Yes, the chain of command test has been utilized by a number of different circuits, and it's certainly one factor to take into consideration in a broader analysis of whether or not he was speaking as an employee or as a citizen. But that question on its own is not dispositive. However, it is not surprising to me that the Fifth Circuit in our particular case did not find that he had a duty to speak. The legal system in the state of Texas isn't exactly, you know, a military hierarchy where everybody has to report to somebody else. The district attorney offices all over the state of Texas have discretion to prosecute cases as they see fit. At the same time, the attorney general is still the head legal counsel for the state of Texas. So
you're not criticizing the state of Texas, are you?
Absolutely not.
Go right ahead.
No, absolutely not. My point is that even though, technically speaking, there's no exact chain of command, at the same time he was reporting to a superior, to the head of the legal system of the state of Texas, who had the capacity to make something happen. in regards to this potential wrongdoing. Finally, also with the letter to the Attorney General, again, he's speaking from a position of knowledge and experience. In this letter, which is only three paragraphs long, he mentions five different times that he's a prosecutor in the Ector County's office, that he, you know, cases must be prosecuted uniformly by dedicated prosecutors like him.
You're saying that if he had written a letter to the U.S. Attorney saying there's corruption in this office and reported the same circumstances, that that would be protected because he's speaking with the special knowledge he acquired as a government employee?
I'm saying that that would not be protected. Yes, it would not be protected. Again, if we... I want to make clear that in this case, there is no actual, you know, corruption. This isn't a typical whistleblowing case. I mean, if the DA had been destroying evidence and he had reported that up the chain of command, then, you know, yes, absolutely, that would be something we would be...
He wrote the UN and said it violated international human rights or something. Would that not be protected? Or President Obama, maybe? When is it... Are you saying the chain of command doesn't have any role in this?
Well, no, that is a good point. I mean, if he is... speaking as a citizen, and that's what, again, the Garcetti test is trying to determine. Is he speaking as a citizen or is he speaking as an employee? So if he steps out of his capacity and writes a letter to President Obama as a citizen in his citizen, you know, capacity, then absolutely that, you know, might be protected at least past the first Garcetti step.
Is it because the person is a fellow prosecutor? Is that the distinction you're making? Because you said the U.S. attorney would not be protected, but President Obama would be.
Well, let me clarify my President Obama statement. What is essential in any sort of speech that he's making, may I finish?
You may finish as well.
Any speech he's making, whether it's up the chain of command or not, what the distinction I'm making is that he cannot speak from a position of special knowledge and experience on the day-to-day workings of his office. That speech is not going to be protected by the First Amendment because the state has a stronger interest in running an efficient office. And so if he separates himself from that and writes a letter purely as a citizen, then yes, that might be protected. But in situations where he is speaking with the knowledge and experience gained from the daily interaction of his office, then no, that is not protected by the First Amendment.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Thank you.
We'll hear from your co-counsel.
May it please the court. My name is Gannett Brahana, and I will address the manner in which Harris's communications failed to reach matters of public concern. And in the event that any communication survived a public concern analysis, the interest of the state in maintaining efficient operations effectively trumped the interest of Mr. Harris in engaging in speech. To begin, opposing counsel appeared to characterize the obligation under Connick of an employee, there's no requirement to bring new information, to bring specific information to bear in public discourse. I would counter that, suggesting that this court and numerous circuits have found in those instances when a communication reached a matter of public concern, either specific allegations or specific information that contributed to a larger public discourse. As the First Amendment protection that's being protected by this course in this jurisprudence that we've been discussing this evening aims...
You need to persuade us that the balancing required by Pickering favors your side of the case. I'm stuck at why isn't this just like Pickering? The school teacher there was regarded as having protected speech and complaining about the school and so forth. And in Pickering, the Supreme Court sided with her.
Justice O'Scanlan, respectfully, I would suggest that this case is distinguishable from Pickering in several ways. Firstly, this court noted in Pickering the fact that the disruption that flowed from the communication was minimal, largely for the fact that the working relationship implicated between a teacher and it was largely members of the board offended in that case. It wasn't an environment that necessitated close working relationships. In the other end of the spectrum, I would suggest you have the Office of the District Attorney, where it would be virtually impossible to say that the task engaged in by these employees, particularly by Mr. Harris, who in addition to his own caseload, was charged with supervisory responsibilities. To say that the disruption wouldn't be exponentially greater in this environment would be difficult. Further, this court in Rankin offered reasoning that's useful to answer your question, I believe, and that there's a burden of caution that accompanies an employee's obligation, and it varies according to the confidentiality that is necessitated by an employee's job.
Well, your opposing counsel told us that the burden is on the employer. In other words, the burden is on you to survive the Pickering test. What's your response? Do you agree with that burden of proof?
I do agree that the burden is on the employer. However, I would qualify that statement by saying that this court has noted that the burden that an employer bears varies according to the degree of the public concern implicated. Further, the greater the disruption, I believe opposing counsel attempted to characterize the necessary showing by the state as being one of actual disruption, effectively trivializing the overtime that was authorized. However, to describe the disruption solely as the authorization of a couple hours overtime would be very difficult. The Third Circuit in Sprague addressed a matter, an issue involving an assistant district attorney who alleged corruption. And just as a side note, as my co-counsel noted, this case on these facts hasn't even gone as far as alleging specific corruption. We have an employee who's looking to capitalize on a degree of discourse that's going on in the public, but brings no specific information to bear. So while no information is brought to the table, the office suffers similar after effects. In Sprague, the court described it as an irreparable breach of confidence.
I'm confused about the Pickering test. You know, you said it's not like the teacher, and because she doesn't deal with the school board. Are you assuming that's because Ector County is a small county and that everybody works in the same office with the DA, and so they're going to have interactions? Or would it matter if it was a big county like Harris County, where you never see the DA because she runs a huge office, and would be more similar to the school board in that case as opposed to the teacher?
I think that the level of disruption that I'm suggesting exists in this case, while perhaps it would be to a slightly lesser degree in a larger office, I think it would still be significantly present and distinguishable from the Pickering case.
But you said exponentially different than the Pickering case. What about this makes it exponentially different than Pickering?
In the first place, opposing counsel attempted to characterize some of the content of the speech as Harris tempering his speech. I would rather characterize it as hedging, in fact, and I think that a consequence of that hedging, the fact that there was no specific information or particular names brought to bear, is the fact that it falls on the whole office. He's implicated not only the district attorney, the head of the office, but essentially he's undermined confidence in the office itself and has dealt a blow to the morale of everyone working in that office. I think that would be a disruption that would be suffered whether you had a smaller office like this one or a larger one, maybe where contact wasn't so frequent. The failure to offer specific information, even to name specific names, implicated the entire office as a result.
Well, couldn't you say that's less disruptive because it's vaguer and it doesn't hit so hard? He's kind of pulled his punch in a way. And so it's not so disruptive because he's not calling some particular person a scoundrel?
Respectfully, Justice Elrod, I would say it is as disruptive, and in addition, the effect of his speech, and I believe his entire aim through each instance of speech, was to take the amount of discourse in the public and to separate himself from the potential animosity that would be targeted towards him, as evidenced in the fact in the first communication that he mentions, I perhaps might have handled the case differently. And in the letter to the Attorney General, the fact that dedicated prosecutors like me should be the ones to handle more cases. So I think effectually he's lumped everyone in the office into a category of wrongdoers and distanced himself in an effort to, through these three communications, further himself professionally. As opposing counsel noted Connick as the perhaps example that we have the clearest so far of the risk of constitutionalizing an employee grievance. I believe this could still be characterized an employee grievance, perhaps not as glaringly so as the facts in Connick, but we have on the facts that he was discontented with his job. And while perhaps he's being considered for an promotion at some point during the proceedings. Our facts did begin with professional discontentment, and as opposed to effectuating change within the system of the office, he went outside by attempting to put himself in the good graces of the public. He went outside the command of his supervisor to the Attorney General. Respectfully, Justice Hartz, in the first communication to the blogger, he alludes to multiple factors that the public is not privy to. Implicit in that communication, I would suggest, is information that he has available to him that the public doesn't, that would perhaps counter the viewpoint that there was corruption. The entire first statement, the fact that he might have prosecuted the case more differently, other facts to consider, the community reaction is not entirely misplaced. Certainly, Justice Hartz. Well, within your question, you also mentioned that you believed that it was clearly out of concern. And my point being in noting the fact that how little substantive information was actually communicated, this would suggest that that was not actually his concern and that his speech was in fact private. As the only clear information that we get from this first, and clear is an understatement, is the fact that he might have prosecuted things differently. This followed from the fact that we know that he was dissatisfied professionally. And as this communication was followed by a letter where repeatedly he appeared to be positioning himself to be receiving greater, a more significant caseload. Shifting to the final communication, the fact that the bulk of that conversation was his dissatisfaction with essentially management policies, which this court has warned that communications that reach largely to policies of an office that are interesting by virtue of the fact that this is an arm of the government are in fact outside the scope of public concern.
You're not arguing that the AG could give him a better caseload, are you? And that's why he wrote this letter.
I'm certainly not arguing that, ma'am. However, I believe it would be impossible to suggest that the AG has no political influence on the office, evidenced partly by the fact the swift authorization of the overtime to immediately respond to the AG. Further, looking at the AG's job description, while generally so, it doesn't seem implausible to suggest that the AG would communicate, and in fact did communicate with the office in regard to the letter. So while certainly not directly, he wouldn't intervene to adjust the caseload of Harris, we do suggest that certainly he could exert influence on the office. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Attorney General Edwards. Apologies.
Time.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will now hear rebuttal.
Your Honors, I'll be very brief. There's only two points I would like to raise in this rebuttal, and the first of which is the fact that opposing counsel is relying on facts that simply do not exist. This record is incomplete. It can't support much of inference of anything as it exists right now. For example, the level of disruption in the office. We pointed out the only disruption that's been raised is the overtime. We don't know how much. We don't know who did it. We have no allegations of any other kinds of disruption. Those are all inferences. And those inferences, to the degree that they can be reasonably made, are to go in Mr. Harris's favor. The same thing with the existence of corruption in the first place. Opposing counsel claimed there was no actual corruption. This is still a question of fact. Well, Your Honor, the primary way to distinguish Connick from these facts was that the level of public concern was minimal. And we do agree that the Pickering balancing test, is dependent on the level of concern, level of public concern. And because it was minimal, the disruption that this employee who had a longstanding grievance had just found out that she was transferred in the Connick case, went home, came back with a very pointed survey, and gave it to her coworkers at work. That was a lot more disruptive than going on your own time, talking to a local community blogger, mailing a letter on your own time, using your own stamp, and privately expressing these concerns like a normal private citizen would. Your Honor, I'm going to...
But doesn't your client...
Excuse
express disdain for the office as a whole, inferentially, in the way he approached his effort here?
Your Honor, we would contest that that would require an inference from the record, and that he expresses his point that it should not have been handled the way that it was. Whether that was done disdainfully or whether it was just a way of saying that this is not the ideal way to run an office, and that the just indicating that this is not the ideal way to run an office in a democratic setting is not expressing disdain for the office. It's serving the very purpose of protected speech to the public, as this court has recognized before. Thank you for your time, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. The case just argued will be submitted for decision, and the court will adjourn. Please be seated. Well, now that we are officially off the bench, I suppose we should be wearing suits here instead of our robes, but pretend we're no longer sitting as judges. We do have an announcement to make in terms of the winning team, and I will designate that in just a minute, but we will follow that announcement with comments from all three members of the panel. We felt it was a very close case. All four oralists did a very fine job. We gave the edge to the respondents. So the respondents are the successful team for this evening. I would like to call on Judge Elrod for comments.
First of all, I want to thank you for having me here. I've had just a splendid day here at Vanderbilt. I've found the students to be engaging, friendly, kind, and so very smart. And I appreciate the hospitality I've been shown. I want to applaud you because I know that you've worked very hard, not just in the weeks leading up to this, but up the entire school year, I understand you've been working very hard on this project, and it shows. So congratulations to all four of you for your tremendous efforts, and I know your classmates have applauded you, and I hope that you will remember this night for many years to come. And I want to encourage you, if you are not the winning team tonight, because I remember back in my law school days when, alas, my team lost the moot court finals. But I ended up succeeding the judge who judged me that night. I believe you will all have very successful careers as advocates, and I encourage you in that, and thank you again for having me.
Judge Hartz?
It's been treating us very well, and I really appreciate it. This has been a fun visit for me, and I thank you very much for having me. My moot court experience was a little less glamorous than yours. It was first year, and I remember the professor said, I really don't want to hear parts on constitutional law. This is just... I hear that from my colleagues a lot now. Before I have a few comments about the argument, this is mainly for the audience, but you know who Connick was in the Connick case, right?
No.
You've heard of Harry Connick Jr.? His father was DA in New Orleans. That's the most important part of the case. cut before of you were very articulate. You speak, all of you speak very well.
That's not always dangerous to being articulate.
If you've
got something to say and you prepared it and you can say it
very well, there's such a temptation to actually say it. So it happens to judges
when they are writing an opinion and they have this beautiful sentence and then they realize, you know, it doesn't fit in the opinion.
So one thing to be careful of is when you're asked a question to be
focused on responding to the question, not saying that wonderful
little statement that you've prepared. I thought
the most responsive one of the four of you was probably the one who had the least polished sentences. What we're interested in is
the responses. When the judges are asking questions, that's what
they're most interested in the case.
Yeah. And what you
have prepared, they may already agree with, or maybe totally disagree, and they don't want to hear something. One thing that I delighted to hear at the beginning,
so I can criticize it,
was, do you want me to recite the facts? Don't ever believe a judge who says, no, I'm familiar with the record. we prepare a lot on my court.
I'm very proud of my court. We know the record
pretty well. But when you're hearing several cases that day and more during the week,
you might get your
facts mixed up,
and occasionally
I'll ask a question and one of my colleagues will nudge me and say, you know, that's the search later today. So if it's an important fact, you might want to make sure you say it anyway. And when I was in practice, this is the main reason I'm making this point, I asked a judge that, a district court judge.
I had a motion hearing and the judge said yes. And it was
so clear by the time of the ruling that
the judge had missed some very important
facts that I wish I hadn't
just
acknowledged or conceded
the point to the judge that, okay, I don't recite it.
You don't want to belabor it, but I wouldn't recommend that question in the future. The last comment I'll make
is one of the most
difficult things for an advocate
to do is know how to disagree with the judge. Sometimes
it's very powerful to say, no, judge, the statute says this. You have to be respectful about it. I thought you did a good job when I thought you weren't being responsive to my question. And
I said, answer my
question essentially.
And you said, I
was answering your question.
This is one of the things you said.
And
it made me
feel better about your being responsive. But that's very difficult to do, and some judges might have been offended
by what you said. But I think you need to
be candid with the judge.
Straightforward with the judge and say, you know, you missed that point. But you're
all going to have great careers in the law,
so this is minor stuff, and you're doing very well.
Very well. I have some personal connection to this case in that Garcetti, which was one of three major cases that are being applied by one side or the other in this argument, came through the Ninth Circuit. We reversed the trial court unanimously, but I wrote a separate concurrence saying that while I vote to reverse, I must say that I do it only because of existing Ninth Circuit authority, which happened to be the Roth case, Roth versus Veterans Administration. And the last paragraph of the of my concurrence, I said, I believe that Roth should be overruled, if not by our court sitting in bank, which it was not, then in due course by the Supreme Court to steer this court's drifting First Amendment jurisprudence back to its proper moorings, which it thereupon did, so I feel very good about that. And it was...
Let me interrupt.
Yeah.
You've had a lot of dissents that have been taken by the Supreme Court. I don't know anyone who's been more successful than you on the courts of appeal.
Can you teach us that?
Well, you're both very, very kind. I guess on U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, you get lots of opportunities to do that. So, but that's just by way of connection to this whole area. It's a very, very active area. You will see any number of cases being brought by public employees. It is an area where the public employee unions are very active. It is a sensitive area because, on the one hand, while it is true, we do have, as was pointed out, these other opportunities through whistleblower statutes and so forth, we still don't want to snuff out truly appropriate First Amendment concerns, and that kind of an issue is going to be with us for a long time. I think most of us feel that the Supreme Court decision in Garcetti made a very substantial contribution to dealing with this when it focused on whether this person was functioning in his employee capacity. Of course, that's what we wrestled with here. I would say, just by one level of general advice, I thought all four participants were quite in command of the facts of the case. But on appeal, while we care about the facts, as Judge Hartz mentioned, we've read all of the briefs. Most of us have had the assistance of law clerks who've helped us distill the relevant facts right down to what we really needed to know. And for almost all of us, the appellate process really has to do with the law. Well, what do the cases require here? Where does this fit? Where do the facts in this case fit in relation to the controlling authorities? And in that regard, I will say that I would suggest that oralists in general be prepared to apply the facts to the case in a more direct way. I think there's a tendency to just deal with the facts without bringing us back to which facts really are important. What does Pickering say? What does Garcetti say? And then how this case fits right squarely into that rule or totally falls entirely outside that rule. To correlate the facts with the controlling legal principles is really the most effective part of this appellate process, and I suggest that's the area for future improvement and focus for all oralists. Today's performance was great. We have four very fine, very qualified student oralists who have done themselves very proud, and it's a pleasure to be part of this panel, which had a chance to evaluate you all. I think that formally ends our process. I'm sure each of us would be happy to take questions if any member of the audience, any of the students, professors, want to ask any questions about the appellate process in the real world. We come from three different circuit courts, and it's conceivable that we might have different perspectives on things. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask. If not, perhaps we should formally, I don't know, is it up to me to formally declare the session over?
It's up to you.
It's up to me. Oh, well, this court stands adjourned.
Thank you.